For a great cup of joe, there's one thing you should know. Your morning brew can also be playful. Buff Boy Brewing guys make the temperature rise, and you surely feel naughty when you swallow our coffee. If you want some real heat, give your mouth a fine treat. You will want some more, rest assured. Buff Boy Brewing, you can't get enough of.
It's time for The Scribble, your weekly fix of celebrity chats, bizarre stories in the news, and basic random chatter with best-selling author and syndicated radio host Jeremy Bradley. Make sure your seat is in the upright and locked position and your barf bag is securely in place. Here's Jeremy Bradley.
Thank you very much, Larson. Jeremy Bradley here. This is The Scribble. We're going to talk about self-checkout at the grocery store. It's the thing that you love to hate doing, right? I don't work here. I'm not ringing up my own groceries. And also going through the old family photo albums and the memories it jogs when you're in lockdown. Plus, Lou Diamond Phillips is joining us to talk about his show on Fox. It all starts right after this.
Who are the Kardashians feuding with now? What did that little thug Justin Bieber do this time? Who's getting hitched and who's headed for Splitsville? Hear the latest celebrity news and gossip every day. An entertainment wrap-up. The good, the bad, the ugly, but mostly the ridiculously hilarious. It's all recapped in this daily segment at entertainmentwrapup.com. Have a laugh at the expense of the rich and famous when they take themselves way too seriously. It's 3 minutes of time-wasting fun at entertainmentwrapup.com. Check out Entertainment Wrap-Up at entertainmentwrapup.com. Brought to you by Speak Free Books.
Jeremy Bradley here, back on The Scribble. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Glad to have you here. These self-checkout things at the store, mostly it's the grocery store, but I've seen them at, you know, Home Depot, the hardware store, and other, and, you know, drug stores or whatever it is. Mainly it's at the grocery store. When this technology first came out, I got to tell you, actually, I remember I was shopping with my mom. So I bought my house, it's over 13 years ago now. For some reason, at the very beginning, when I first moved out, my mom kind of panicked, like I wouldn't be able to find food, like I wouldn't be able to go grocery shop, like I would starve, that I wouldn't know how to walk to the store, buy a grocery item, and then eat and survive. And so my mom would often call me and ask about if I needed to go grocery shopping or if I needed anything. Well, if she was going to do just, you know, an Instacart service, I absolutely could have just, you know, emailed her, texted her by a shopping list and then waited, you know. I wouldn't let her in the door. She'd have to leave it at the door, ring the bell, and then walk away like you do now. But anyway, no, she meant well. And so the first time that I saw these self-checkout things, I was with my mom, and we went. And I don't know that technology has improved as much, you know, since then. But I remember going and I said, hey, let's try it. Like, it was cool, right? It was a new thing to do. And within minutes, we absolutely regretted it, because you know where I'm going with this. You know what happened, right? Please wait for an attendant. Please wait for attendant. Please wait for attendant. Please wait for attendant. And at one point, I actually even said to the employee, can you just finish this for us? And she said no. And so at that point, my mom had said, never again. I distinctly remember her saying it. I can hear her saying it in that voice. Never again. Never again am I doing the self-checkout, because it was that one experience. That was enough. We're done. You don't get a second chance in that regard. And it's not like we were buying, you know, it's not that, you know, it's just her and my dad at home. So she's not shopping for, you know, five kids and a grandparent and a dog and what. No. It's just her and my dad. And for me, it was just me at the time. So we didn't have, you know, we didn't have full carts or baskets of groceries and things, but it was just enough to be frustrating where, you know, we should have just gone, even if we had to wait in line, and because that was why we went through the self-checkout, is that they were all open. All the lights were blinking. There was nobody there. Well, now we understand why, right? And so even my mom said, you know what? I would have stood in that line of people for 20 minutes rather than do the self-checkout. Like, just have the employee do it. And now over time, people are kind of saying the same thing. I don't work at the store. Why am I doing the job? How can you expect me to do this now? And so I was reading an article, and this is sort of what brought it on. The article is from The Atlantic, The Banana Trick and Other Acts of Self-Checkout Thievery. And it basically just kind of talks about how people have that same train of thought. There's still that mentality of, I don't work here. You have this grudge because you're making me do the work. I've got to, you know, I've got to scan everything. I've got to bag it. Do you remember Canadians? I'm going to talk to the Canadians on this one. Superstore or Loblaws, whatever it was called. Do you remember that first time when you had to bag your own groceries? Now, we're going back probably about 15, 20 years ago. I remember going to the store called Superstore with my, you know, with my mom when we were shopping as a kid. And I remember it being so ridiculous that we had to bag our own groceries. So all they do is they would scan it, put it on a little belt, and then it would go down towards you, right? You'd push down the little conveyor belt. And then as a teenager, when I was this rebellious teenager who was like, excuse me, this is your job. I remember trying to take a stand and be like, you're not bagging it for us? And they're like, nah, no, we don't do that here. And little did I know, as this, you know, teenager who just wants to be a dick, no tantrum that I could throw, nothing would make them, I still need to bag it. I don't care what I say. So that was kind of eye-opening for me. But then when the whole self-checkout thing comes around, and now you're making me scan the stuff and bag it, you know, well, that's where people say is that I don't work here. I'm not doing self-checkout. So not only am I having to pay to be here, to, you know, I'm buying the stuff and sometimes it's overpriced and what have you. Now I'm helping you guys cut down on labor and save costs by me doing it for you. And so people, from what I'm reading here in this article and just from the conversations that I've had, is that people resent that. They go and say, I'm going to go to the cashier every single time. Not because, you know, the poor person is keeping a job. It's not even because of that. It's just to put your foot down and say, I'm not on the payroll here, so I don't. Now, again, this article in The Atlantic is basically going and saying this is where people don't feel bad about stealing. This is where ringing up a T-bone steak with the code for a cheap variety of produce is called the banana trick. And so then it also says that people scope out things of the same weight so that if you put it in the bag, it's not going to detect that unexpected item and please wait for an attendant kind of message. And it, you know, it just, again, it talks about how people just haven't had any remorse or sympathy for stealing when you go and just add an extra item or maybe you put a different code or whatever it is. And it ends up costing the stores a lot, obviously, right? Because you don't have anybody monitoring and watching. And so that's sort of my question to you all is, have you stolen using the self-checkout? Now, let me be clear. We're not naming names. This is private correspondence that you're sending to us, okay? Here's the deal. I will make an admission today, everybody. I will tell you that it absolutely has happened to me. Here is why. Because I got so frustrated that it wasn't scanning the item and it was constantly calling the person, whatever, that at one point I ended up just saying, you know what? I'm just going to throw another one in the bag. Because it was the frustration, it was the hassle. Now, does that excuse stealing? Absolutely not. I'm not even saying because you inconvenienced me, I'm going to take this free. I'm not saying that was my mentality. What I'm saying is that wasn't correct. That wasn't the right thing to do. Am I admitting to stealing from a store on this show right now, right here? Yes, I am. And obviously, like I said, the fact that there's an entire article about it and says how people do it and why people do it, you know, that's kind of the thing here. Somebody, there was a Reddit discussion, it says, there is no moral issue with stealing from a store that forces you to use self-checkout, period. They are charging you to work at their store. There you go, right? But tell me your thoughts. Send me an email. live@jbonair.com. live@jbonair.com. And again, like I said, this story in The Atlantic references quite a high percentage of people surveyed on the internet. Now, again, take that as you will. Who say that, yeah, you know what, I have. I've left with something that I didn't scan or I didn't pay for. live@jbonair.com.
Isn't it crazy that you wait for payday, but before you know it, you're strapped for cash again? It's time to stop blowing your money and become a smart spender with the book, The Official Guide to Being an American Cheapskate at cheapskatebook.com. Learn simple ways to cut costs at home every day and during special times of the year. Don't go broke at Christmas. Don't remortgage the house for a fancy vacation. The book is filled with tips to save you money throughout the year. Check out the best-selling book, The Official Guide to Being an American Cheapskate at cheapskatebook.com or on Amazon and iTunes.
Jeremy Bradley here, back on The Scribble. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm surrounded by memories of our different radio broadcasts. Not so much the podcast, because with the podcast, we don't actually produce specific travel programming for the podcast because it just doesn't work that way. So those are called leftovers, a crossover. When I do different things in Mexico or Indianapolis or San Francisco, that's all stuff from the radio shows, and we just kind of give it to you here on the podcast as a bonus. So There you go. Don't you feel special now? But what my point is that when I look around, there's so many different random pictures of events and things that I was at. Behind me, in our because I'm in the radio studio, is our Wall of Fame. So when I've done red carpets, and there's me with celebrities, and there's, you know, there's just so many great pictures on the wall. And then now we have these other sort of random ones kind of around the room. And I just happened to glance over. There's one of me. It looks like I'm jumping off of a building back first, basically. And we did that in San Francisco. So when we were doing travel programming with the tourism boards, sometimes we have outtakes of photos or the photos that we actually use with our programming. And this was one where it was like a 3D, I'm going to call it a museum. It wasn't really a museum in the traditional sense, but it was 3D murals on floors and walls of this building. So essentially what it was that you come in there, you are assigned to a photographer, one of their people there taking pictures, and you basically go around to all these different stations, and there's different backdrops, there's different settings, and they're painted on the wall. But when you look from a different, from a certain angle, it actually looks 3D, like you're in the scenario. And so there's one where you're in a, you know, a streetcar that's got a hole in the floor and it looks like you're about to fall out. There's one, like I said, where I'm jumping off this building. And really what it is that I'm laying on the floor. I'm really just laying on the floor, legs out, legs open, arms out. And now if you look really closely, you can see, you know, where like the wall and the floor meet, you know, like that, the crease in the, but if you look at quick glance, I mean, you almost have to do a double take. Like, I mean, is he jumping off the building? Like, what am I seeing here? What is that? And we just had such a fun time, and it just reminds me of one of those random moments where, when we would do travel programming, remember when you could travel and go places? Good times. But we went there, it was at least like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. When we were in San Francisco, so this is a year and a half ago, maybe, almost close to 2 years, we were there covering Pride. We were there, you know, with the festivities for Pride. And then at night, and then early in the morning, outside of the Pride Festival hours, we were taping travel programming with the tourism board. And so we spent the whole day at Pride, you know, baking in the sun and, you know, just exhausted from the heat and everything. And then all of a sudden we pack up and we go, and then we would do these different segments. And so in San Francisco, we had... oh, it was just such a good time. It really was. Anyway, so at like 10:30, 11 o'clock, we're in the car. And at this point, I know kind of what we're doing. We're going to a 3D museum. I was like, all right, cool. And that's when they're starting to tell me, all right, you're meeting with this person. We're talking this. This is what it is. And then I really only get briefed on it sometimes, you know, 5-10 minutes before we get there. And I was like, all right, this sounds kind of interesting. Like it's a 3D museum. All right, cool. And then I get there. And when you walk around... It's at first, at the beginning, I was like, okay, it's just a bunch of things painted on the wall, whatever. Then I see the pictures of the people, like they have examples on the wall and that they can show you. And I was like, okay, this looks really cool. And it's, you know, I had a couple drinks too before going there. And when you're in it, you almost just get to play around. Like you just get to sort of jump around, be silly, lay here. I mean, you kind of do what they tell you because they know what looks best in the photos. But it was just such a good time. And so... Yeah, it's kind of cool. So whenever people are having, you know, a bad day or they just... I look around the room and go, I've done some pretty crazy, funny things over my career in broadcasting, which is now, you know, 15 years or whatever it is. So I don't know why I felt the need to tell you that story. I just did. Because you know what? Here's the deal. Do we have time to go a little bit longer? Okay. Pictures are such a remarkable thing. I talked about my grandma dying shortly after... testing positive for corona. This was in, was it November already? October? November. It was November. And only now, because, you know, obviously the time needs to, you know, heal and mourn and grieve and get over it, which we're still not over it. I'm not going to say that we got over, you know, a 93-year-old woman with a snap of a finger. Point is that it's only now that we're kind of going back to her house. She was in a home for about a year and a half-ish, and it was like the house stood still, like time stood still there. And when we go there, now again, an old woman, an old lady, 93 years old, has a ton of photo albums from the past. And so my mom, my aunt, and my uncle have spent so much time at the house going through things. And my mom gave me an envelope of photos. Remember going to the photo mat back in the day, right? You'd take your roll of film and then you'd come back in a week. Sometimes you could get it in an hour, right? Towards the end, you can get them done in an hour. But, this is long before you had that instant gratification of taking a picture and then seeing what it looks like, right? You always used to just, you would take one picture of something. If it didn't work out, too bad. And you'd have to wait a week to find out if you got the shot. And so my mom had given me this big, huge envelope. I would say it's at least 100 and some photos of like me as a baby, me as a kid, me growing up. There was my high school graduation. And it's just interesting that, you know, you amass such a treasure trove of memories. And I mean, it's expected. But what I'm saying is that it's a generation that is not going to happen anymore. Think about it. Think about if you are in your 20s right now, perhaps your parents, that would make them, let's say, 40. Okay. They haven't had photos developed. So what are you going to inherit? A CD? A flash drive? Their phone? How are you going to inherit, you know, those pictures? Or how are you going to, right? And here's the deal, that if they died and you don't know the code to their phone to get into it, you could kiss all those pictures goodbye. So it's fascinating. I'm still very old school in the sense that I really appreciate flipping through, literally holding in my hand, flipping through photos, because those just take you back to a time. In our family, we used to go camping, you know, depending on when the family member, my aunts, uncles, my parents would get vacation time. Generally, it was 2 weeks. We would all go camping. So everybody would pack up their little camper trailer things, and we would drive east of the city, about 2.5 hours, to the same campground every year. And everybody had a station wagon at the time. So my parents, my aunt and uncle, my grandparents, all had, so there would be station wagons lined up. It would be that's what our family would do. So we vacationed as a family, not just me, my two brothers. I was going to say my three brothers. I've got two brothers. My parents, my two brothers, and me, not just as a family that way. It was with our grandparents, with my cousins, that was just what we did. And we had such a great time. We just knew that campground, you know, inside out. And there would be so many pictures of us doing silly things, or, you know, my grandpa playing tetherball with us. Do you remember tetherball? Remember when you could all, you know, legally touch a ball and play at the same time before this whole corona thing? Do you remember when you were able to do that? And it was just so fun. So when I flipped through, now bear in mind that I was 5, 6, 7 years old when we were doing this, so the memories for me are a little bit hazy, but I do remember playing tetherball. I do remember, you know, watching my cousins and my brothers water ski. I was too small to do it at the time, but, you know, and so it lives on through these memories of the photographs that you look through and you see. So I don't know what my point is. I'm not telling people to now start going and buy cameras and develop film, because I don't know how many places you can have your film developed still. But definitely, you know what? It's definitely worth going through your pictures. Everybody seems to have that complaint of, I take so many pictures and I never do anything with them. You know what? Get them printed out. Make a photo album. That's something, especially with corona lockdown or just on a shitty weather weekend, definitely something to do. It really is, you know. And there's times when I was flipping through those photos, I actually kind of had to stop because it was just, I became emotional, you know, you lose your grandma. The last time I saw my grandma was August, and she died November. So think about that, right? Where she's tested positive in October, she's lived with it for, you know, maybe a month almost, and you don't get to see her, you don't get to talk to her, you don't get to be with her. I mean, that's, so the emotions were there, let alone, you know, her dying from it. But, so I had to stop. I couldn't look through all 100 and some photos at one time. And I just kind of came back to it again. And, you know, I smile, right? And then you have a good memory. And so, anyway, I don't know why I'm waxing sentimental on that one, but feel free to give me a shout, live@jbonair.com. live@jbonair.com. We're back after this on The Scribble.
Ever had something to get off your chest but never had the balls to say it? That's a load of crap. Speak Free with JB.com is exactly what you've been waiting for. Your chance to tell it like it is and not care what anybody else thinks. Have your say on issues of the day. Join newspaper and radio columnist Jeremy Bradley as he tells it like it is. Hundreds of thousands of people have stopped by, including some well-known celebrities who have had a chat with JB and speak candidly about what's really going on in the world. You can join them too. Have a rant or a rave. Be brave and head on over to www.speakfreewithjb.com now.
I'm intrigued by the show Prodigal Son on Fox, and so you know what that means, right? I've got to talk to the cast. Lou Diamond Phillips is joining us to chat about the show. Hello, Lou Diamond Phillips, the legend.
Thank you, Jeremy. You've got to go to the horse's mouth, right? So I'll be the horse. I'm okay with that.
All right. let's talk about that. You know, I'll admit that when I first heard about the show, I guess it's about 2 years ago now, I wondered if we needed more of this kind of drama on TV. And then I saw it and I was like, yeah, we need this. What compelled you to do the show?
That's exactly it. You know, Jeremy, you know, you go, oh my gosh, you know, another police procedural. I mean, you know, how many angles can you come at this from? And, you know, as soon as I read the Prodigal Son script, I realized, well, this is a totally different take. You know, you've seen profiler shows, you've seen cop shows, but this is a genius profiler played by Tom Payne, named Malcolm Bright, who is so good at his job because his father is a serial killer.
Right.
You know, who was fortunately, you know, in prison. And that's the jumping off place where then it turns into, you know, the family dynamics of how does, you know, like Bernie Madoff, how does his family deal with his infamy after this? How does it affect, you know, the baggage that the son is carrying? And then, you know, you add into the mix the entire police procedural, because he's now working with my team at the NYPD Major Crimes, and I happen to have a connection to the family because I'm the one who arrested his dad. So, you know, it's got a little Silence of the Lambs, a little This Is Us. Family crime drama, let's put it that way.
It's a daytime soap opera and primetime drama all in one is what it is.
Basically, yeah. and you know, the other thing that I think is much appreciated, certainly by the cast and the fandom, is that it has this wicked sense of humor. I mean, it can get twisted, and you know, the many fans have said, I can't believe I'm laughing at this, but I am, you know. So the writers have an incredibly deft touch when it comes to the black comedy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so yeah, writing is a, you know, big part of it, obviously, but I think, I mean, the casting is great. But there's just something that seems so natural about everybody's role that they're in.
You know, everybody is spot on, and I think, obviously, they did a great job in the beginning, but what's nice is that, you know, after a season and a half, you get the sense that the writers really know us, and they write to our strength. They write to what we've brought to the table as the characters, and as a result, you know, every character who is a series regular, you know, just gets more rich, gets more deep. We investigate backstories, and you know, it's very exciting. I mean, for instance, you know, the medical examiner, Teresa Tanaka, played by Keiko Agana, you know, she gets her own episode coming up soon because she's such a fan favorite.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you then what you brought. You talk about actors bringing things to the table, and I always want to know when somebody, you know, either plays a doctor or a politician, how much either research did you do or how much have you learned along the way about police work? I mean, does it give you a new appreciation for the job?
I've always had an appreciation for the job. I've always backed our police. I've always backed our firefighters, our first responders. That's something that I've done my entire life. And that's, you know, probably part and parcel of being a military brat, you know, having grown up on Navy bases around the world and you know, really having a respect for people who, you know, are duty-bound. And when I came into this, it's interesting, I didn't really need that much more research because I played a lot of cops. You know, I played regular cops, I played FBI, you know, I've done military films. And I've specifically done research when it comes to serial killers. For the first Power, I rode around with Detective Bob Grogan for about a week. He was one of the men who helped capture the Hillside Stranglers. And then I recently, with Bellamy Young, who is also in the cast, did a movie about Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. And so I worked with Detective Gil Carrillo, who was part of that task force. So very much like the character, you know, I have this history and I have this baggage that I bring onto the scene, and you know, it's just part of you know, the fabric of who I am, you know, and that I can reach into my back pocket and you know, have these things at my disposal.
And you're not just starring in this show. I was told, did you get to flex your directing muscles at one point as well?
I did. The episode that was last aired, the mid-season break, episode 7, was one that I got to direct. And not only was the crime of the week absolutely, you know, mouth-watering and fun,
yes,
about the beauty sector, you know, and plastic surgery, I got to introduce Catherine Zeta-Jones to our cast, and Alan Cumming is briefly introduced at the end of my episode, and the episode that's coming up is all about him. So I had an absolute banquet when it came to getting to direct this show. In addition to the fact that I love the writers and I absolutely adore every single member of this cast.
But I got to ask you, I mean, how do you do that? I mean, I would have like multiple personalities. So you're jumping in front of the camera, and then you're going behind. How do you do it?
It's ridiculously schizophrenic. there's no two ways about it. It's prep, man. It's all about prep, and it's having the kind of crew that you trust implicitly. You know, I as an actor know when I've got it. I know when I've given a good take. And then all I have to do is look at the DP and say, was I standing in the shadow? Is it in focus? Are we good? How did it look to you? And if they say yes, we move on. You know, and if there's ever any question, there's video playback. So, I mean, the support system is there to allow you to do this. And quite honestly, you know, when you have a cast as accomplished as ours, mm-hmm. you're just tweaking little things. You're just making suggestions. You're not teaching an acting class. You're not giving a dissertation. You're not having to pull a performance out of anybody. So it's really about creating an environment where they can do their best work, you can do your best work, and that everybody's relaxed as much as, you know, as possible, you know, when you have, you know, 12 hours to do a ton of work.
And I guess after you've done so many episodes together, you know, as a group anyway, you kind of all just have, you just have this groove going and it's, you know, it just comes naturally.
100%. And you lean on that. I mean, especially having been there, you know, I actually had an advantage over some of the directors who were coming in for the first time because, you know, there's a level of communication and trust that I have with the cast and the crew to where, you know, we're reading each other's mail. They're anticipating what I want. And if they don't, then it's all about communication. It's about communication and being very clear and being decisive.
So my next logical question then is, do you prefer behind the camera or in front? If you could only do one job, you can't be selfish, only one job, what would it be?
That's just it. I cannot, you know, if I were forced to, you know, acting was my first love. But,
yeah.
You know, having come from the theater and having, you know, taken the costume classes, having taken the set design classes, and, you know, the tap dancing, which I was terrible at, you know, you learn to do it all, and you learn to appreciate it all. And I view it as you know, branches of the same creative tree. You know, the umbrella is being a communicator or being a storyteller. And you know, I'm just using a different tool set, you know, whenever I get behind the camera or, you know, whenever I write, you know, having screenplays or a novel or whatever it is. It's just my, you know, ability and trained ability, you know, to tell a story.
We'll talk about more of your writing in a second, but you're lucky that this isn't a Zoom call because I would have demanded to see the tap dancing.
No, it's pretty terrible. I've got a lazy left foot, for to tell it. I'm ambidextrous with my hands, as you know, evidenced in my, you know, knife throwing and young guns. But you know, when it comes to putting, you know, making both feet work at the same time, no, not so good.
This
I
is
can't shuffle off the Buffalo, man.
This is where you you blame it as quarantine foot, I guess.
There you go.
Almost at a time. I always have to give, you know, a fellow author a shout out to plug their book. You put out a new one last fall. Quickly tell everybody about it.
Absolutely. It's called The Tinderbox, Soldier of Indira. It's inspired from the short story by a fairy tale by Hans Christian Andersen. And beyond that, it was actually inspired by a series of drawings that my wife was doing that were supposed to be a graphic novel. And it's a sci-fi fantasy fable that, you know, fortunately has been incredibly well. It came out in November. It topped a lot of the Amazon lists. It's still going strong, and I'm actually working on the sequel.
Ooh, when can we expect that?
Between, you know, being actually able to, you know, have worked as an actor,
right,
and sometimes directing, it's slow going, but the first novel took 10 years. This one is moving along quite much more quickly, to be quite honest. So I'm hoping to get it out next year.
Oh, I thought you were going to say maybe 9 years. Okay, we'll take it next year.
Exactly.
Sure. Before then, though, we're going to be watching Prodigal Son on Fox, right? When can we catch the show?
Absolutely. We come back on Tuesday the 13th with a fantastic episode with Alan Cumming. And Catherine Zeta-Jones is now a regular. She's with us for the rest of the season. And those who have been watching the show, it really raises some questions that a lot of people have been asking for a long time. So it gets very, very twisty, very turny. And this one's also very entertaining because Alan is just an absolute joy to watch. Thank you.
We got you. All right, Lou Diamond Phillips, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeremy. Have a good one.
We hear you chirping. Get scribbling. Tweet up the scribble at the Scribble Show. Join the discussion with Jeremy Brathen. It's all going down right now on Twitter at the Scribble Show and at thescribbleshow.com.
My name is Jeremy Bradley. This is The Scribble. Live at jbonair.com is the email address. My thanks to Lou Diamond Phillips for joining us. I will talk to you same time, same place next week right here on The Scribble. Remember to subscribe if you like what you hear. Bye for now.
Want more Scribble? Check out thescribbleshow.com for past shows, celebrity interviews, cheapskate tips, and more. That's at thescribbleshow.com and on Twitter at The Scribble Show. The Scribble is a speak-free media presentation.
If you want some real heat, give your